This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Jet stream gets blown off course again, this time by Nuri, the most powerful storm on the planet. Arctic air spills into central and eastern North America in mid-November, while another awful storm track shapes up for Britain and northern Europe. We live through the time of climate disruption. But what does it mean? Our first guest, David Collings, talks about our stolen future and broken present. Then it's a quick tour of bright minds from Scandinavia. From Sweden, forest expert Martin Persson says tropical deforestation is still raging, still stripping the planet. For us, the consumers in rich countries. Then Finnish intellectual Olli Tammiletto asks whether we can survive a system which rewards the rich with super-consumerism. There is a better way. This is Radio EcoShock. What is climate change? It's not an event. It's a complete change of context in which events take place. And no wonder we have trouble grasping it. And I'm reminded of that viral video, once again, where a man filming a triple rainbow breaks down in tearful wonder, and he says over and over again, "What does it mean?" And on Radio EcoShock, we go into depth with scientists who explain the functioning of the atmosphere, the soil, and the sea, and the creatures who live there. Today, we're going into the humanities to ask scholar David A. Collings, what does it mean? Collings has written about romanticism, poetry, and monstrous society. He's a professor of English at Bowdoin College in Maine. Now he's turned to the largest story of this or any other generation, human disruption of the climate. His new book is titled Stolen Future, Broken Present, The Human Significance of Climate Change. David Collings, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
It's been a long journey from the British Romantics to, you know, a couple of centuries ago to the hard science of climate change. What stimulated you to make this leap?
I was a little frustrated by the fact that all of us are going through so much just as human beings, and it was hard for me to find anyone discussing that fact. I read widely in the science and the policy, the economics, the technologies surrounding climate change, and just felt so many emotions and so many thoughts that eventually I thought, okay, if no one else is writing about it, I should do it myself. So it's definitely a departure for me, but it was transformative finally to get those thoughts from my own mind out into the world and share them with other people. Very therapeutic, very positive to enter conversations like this one with other people. I wrote it just as a human being or a fellow citizen, and hope that people will read it in that spirit and just enter a conversation about our emotions and our thoughts facing what we now face.
It's a good read. I really enjoyed it, and many of the things I'd been thinking were in the book, but said better than I could have said them. So we do hardly know what we're looking at, and I just was stuck on this short blip from the editor's introduction to your book. They say, quote, "Climate change concerns material agencies that impact on biomass and energy, erased borders, microbial invention, geologic and nanographic time, and extinction events." That's almost everything. David, is climate change an everything?
It's close, because the context is so vast that it's difficult to say anything would be exempt from the consequences of climate change. But luckily, it's different from everything in the sense that at least it's about the climate and is about specific environmental consequences. So that is helpful. But some of my friends remind me, some scientists who work on other areas of science, they remind me about the extinction event we're living through, for example. Other scientists point to concerns around the decline in water supplies. Or still others point to the effects of nitrogen fertilizer. So from their point of view, climate change is one contemporary crisis, but there are many other crises that we should be attending to as well. In effect, they would say we have a broad, sweeping environmental crisis and should think about it more broadly. And they're right. And I accept that perspective. In many ways, my book works on that level as well. It simply asks us how we relate to the broad environmental crisis that we face.
Well, for me, your book is a little bit like Sigmund Freud and the couch saying, and how do you feel about that, you know? Because that's something we haven't grappled with.
That is, that's right. And it is a strange kind of reality that we face because our emotions no longer feel quite right. Our sense of our own mortality has to change, for example, or our sense of grief. Because if we look ahead to see what we're going to be losing, we will be sacrificing a great deal because of climate change. So we might feel some grief about that fact. And there are many different things we may grieve, the loss of human beings, the loss of landscapes, the loss of livelihoods, and so on. But the tricky thing is, normally speaking, when we grieve, we go through the process, come out the other side, heal to some extent, and can go on with our lives. With the grief around climate change, we will go through the process, but it may never end, because what we are grieving will still be in front of us, still arriving, and probably getting worse and worse. So grief changes. We might even grieve over the loss of what we once recognized as grief. That's one example. Many other examples are powerful as well. Longing for a certain future for ourselves, going to school, raising children, many enterprises at work, lots of different things we do take for granted a certain future. But if that future is eroding or disappearing or is at least in doubt, then those qualities of hope and desire or just planning pragmatically for the future begin to erode as well. So it's almost as if our emotions are strange and peculiar, difficult to name and characterize. So what we're living through may be almost like a change in the climate of emotion and the climate of what it means to be human. So it's very difficult for us to speak about these things intelligently. Our languages, our genres, our narratives, our usual modes of comprehension just aren't up to the task. And we sort of need to begin the task of inventing new languages, or at least facing up to the warped and frayed realities of our emotions as they are.
And you write about losing our civilization as a possibility, but we all grew up knowing our civilization could be destroyed on short notice, maybe because of a computer error or a human mistake launching a devastating nuclear war. Talk to us about the difference between the nuclear threat and climate change.
That's a great subject. A really powerful comparison. Yes, good question. It seems to me that nuclear war, oddly, had a clarity and a directness that we lack with climate change. Very few of us doubted that nuclear war would be possible, whereas many people doubt that climate change is real or that we're causing it. So that's one difference. Nuclear war, if it took place, would devastate us. It would be the end. There wouldn't be much afterwards. Even if we have post-apocalyptic movies and fictions, they're fundamentally fantasies. There wouldn't be much left. Whereas in climate change, it can happen to us and then keep happening and then keep happening. So we live through it in this long, continuous process and a kind of frustrating tedium of endurance and survival, very different from nuclear war. There's also a difference in our knowledge. Nuclear war, we might understand because we created nuclear weapons. We might understand who the players are. So we could manage it politically to some extent. We could come up with treaties or forms of international agreements, maybe even nuclear weapons pacts to try to limit the possibility of a nuclear war. Whereas with climate change, it's politically unstable. We still haven't found a way to bring everyone together, to find the formula that developing and developed nations will both accept, and so on. So in many ways, nuclear war, we might even be nostalgic for the discourses that it gave us. In climate change, we're in a much murkier, much more difficult environment.
Yeah, I love those days of living in nuclear doom. Many of us can only, you know, getting to the reality of life, we can only stand the many acts of injustice and violence that are daily reported because we think in the long run it may get better. For 400 years, we believed in progress. Now, what happens to this society if we think, even for a moment, progress may be over and things will actually get worse?
It's quite an event. You're absolutely right. We have believed for a long time, especially in this country, but throughout the developed West since the Enlightenment, that we can slowly, incrementally transform our societies and make them more just. We believed in economic growth so that the standard of living would gradually rise for most people. We've looked forward to these things in such a deep way, we may not even be aware of how they have unconsciously formed our ideas. One of the consequences, I think, is that we have gradually become more and more likely to extend new rights and new privileges to people who did not formerly have them. We sometimes have resisted, especially in the history of Western democracies, the expansion of rights to new races, to immigrants, to women, to gay people, etc., except that we eventually decide to do so more or less confident that we would not be losing much ourselves, that we were part of this expanding pie. So it strikes me that looking ahead to a future in which that pie will be shrinking or may be harmed, our optimism, which has shaped our politics, is also harmed. And to pursue the thought that Octavia Butler proposes in her two-novel sequence on climate change, we may find ourselves revisiting some of the oppressive systems of the past. She imagines the return of slavery, a particular version of it, but it's a shocking possibility. In other words, we might regress rather than progress. And more deeply, it leads to the question of what our whole set of political assumptions will become if we no longer have political hope. What will our relationship to each other be? What will our concerns be about new rights and new possibilities if we're not even sure our civilizations will endure? It's interesting to me, when I teach a lot of this material to my students, they have accepted these possibilities. So one of the things you asked me just a moment ago is, what will happen if we don't have this optimism? We're learning already that in the younger generation, a lot of them lack that optimism, but they still carry on. So it may well be that we will just continue to do much of what we do, but with less faith that things will improve in the future.
And one of the great hopes, as we know, of the 20th century was revolution. And my recent Radio EcoShock guest, Frank Rotering, says that the climate deadline, maybe a decade to act at the best, means there's no time for revolution. What do you think?
That's a sobering thought, and I probably agree with them. I completely agree that this is a revolutionary situation. In the book, I describe an ecological revolution that in some ways is required for us to do what we need to do. In the very least, it would be like the sexual revolution, in the sense that everyone would participate. It would have broad consequences. It may not necessarily come from above, or it could be like the French Revolution, where it could come from above. So there are many ways to model what we need. However, in order to build the case for revolution, we need plenty of time to sway the public, to change the laws, to alter the entire political situation. That tends to take us quite a while. If we think back to the amount of time it took the civil rights movement to have an effect, or the women's movement to have an effect, things tend to move gradually in Western democracies. The problem with climate change is that it thinks biologically rather than politically. It may transpire that we will cross biological tipping points before we have a political consensus. So in the book, I talk about our patience, our political patience, as a problem. It's as if we take our political realities more seriously than the realities of the biosphere. In some weird way, politics are more real to us than nature itself. If we took nature seriously enough, we would alter our politics and do so very quickly. But again, that's not likely, given the context in which we live politically.
Yes, and, you know, revolutions of the past promised more freedom and a better life, and this climate revolution seems to ask for less freedom, a more constrained, materially poorer kind of life. Who's going to revolt for that?
Exactly. Who's the constituency? You could argue it's all of us, but in some way it's none of us. So I describe it as the impossible revolution. If you look at all the different things that we would have to do to bring about the ecological revolution, it seems to cut against all the things that revolutions typically provide us: more freedom, better opportunities, a more optimistic sense of things. revolutions tend to put the individual, or at least human beings, more at the center, whereas this one does the opposite. Nevertheless, I think we still have to try to carry it out. As I suggest at one point, we have to do the impossible. So this revolution seems impossible, but we should still try to bring it about.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, English professor David Collings. In your book, Stolen Future, Broken Present, you write about stealing from the future as though that wasn't the basis of this whole civilization anyway. I mean, countries borrow obscene amounts of money to be paid by future taxpayers. Most of us borrow from the future to buy a house or car or a vacation. Stealing from the future, David, that's what we do.
Well, when we borrow, we're not necessarily stealing. It's true, the paradigm is very close to the societies of credit and of debt that we've built up ever since the 17th century. That has indeed been the basis of modern economic relationships and of politics. However, the difference is that stealing a future in relation to climate change also operates on another scale. Because we're putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that will be there for at least a century, if not longer, the people in the future who figure out what we should do and take action to ward off even further climate change will have their hands tied, because our actions today will have led to levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that will more or less undo what future people will be able to try to do. So in effect, we are counter-revolutionaries of the future. In 50 years, people will be trying to create events that we will be forestalling or preventing. In that sense, we are stealing the future politically from people who follow us. But it's also true, I think, that our own day could be described in similar terms. Those who came before us have put us in a pickle because there are just too many people on the planet. The causes of climate change and the causes of overpopulation share a great deal. So I would suggest that climate change and us in our sheer numbers are co-heirs of a lot of decisions that took place in the past. In an odd way, then, our own future has been stolen, although not nearly as vividly as we're stealing the future from those who follow us in relation to climate change.
Well, one last thing on the future. You write, quote, human societies have always had a strong image of the future. And I argue that many past societies had a stronger image of the past. There were countless efforts to pretend to be building the new Roman Empire. Ancient societies often look back to the Golden Age, which was much greater than the present. Maybe we'll fall into that pattern again, and people will look back on these times now as the Golden Age.
We might. I agree with you. I think that some social theorists emphasize the enormous value of those real or mythic pasts to contest the contemporary. So the Golden Age, or notions of Eden or pastoral bliss, were often invoked by people to undercut the forms of power they saw around them in their own time. In effect, the past has been a weapon to recommend a better future. There's a deep affinity between that past and the future. For us, however, if we go forward into a future that looks increasingly dim and we get more and more nostalgic for the past, the logic will be a bit different. We truly will be longing for a past that does not promise us anything for what is to come. We'll have a nostalgia that has a wicked level of intensity. It's interesting, though, because one can have, even today, a certain nostalgia for the present. If we're aware of what's coming, and we look around us and see what we have still today, we might have an intense emotional relationship to the present, knowing it's going to fade rapidly. So nostalgia itself has a different quality today, because we're living in the good old days right now.
And how does it help us to imagine the ruins of our country in the future? Why is it different to imagine future ruins as opposed to ancient ruins like the Colosseum or the pyramids?
It's interesting to compare the two, because we are talking about ruined landscapes, destroyed civilizations, and so on. But the emotions are going to be different, in part because we ourselves may endure, even after our cities or coastlines, landscapes and other places with which we're familiar have decayed or frayed or cracked or been destroyed. Oddly, we're going to be surviving our own ruins, which is not the case for the Romans, who themselves went into decline as the Colosseum endured. So we will, in effect, be spectators of the ruins of the civilizations in which we ourselves once lived.
You know, I was really struck by your passages on the mortality of nature. We humans expect nature to live beyond our mere mortality, but in this case, as you just said, we may continue living while the nearby forest or lake dies. The wild fields of my childhood have been paved over. The forest I played in has been cut down. And I'm not sure where that leaves me. Some of the time, I don't really know where I am. Can you relate to that?
I can indeed. I think that that's a good metaphor for what we're living through. Some of the old poets would describe in their elegies for someone they loved, the death of a person as permanent, whereas nature would go on. And we've now flipped things around so much that nature may die, even though we go on. So that, as you suggested, and as I've lived through too, landscapes we love, or even species we love, have gone into decay or been threatened or paved over, and here we still are. So some of the metaphors or ways we understand mortality have shifted. It's as if we live too long, and the world we live in is living too short, reversing everything that we're used to.
Of course, it could go the other way. You know, people have an urge to talk about the past with their children, but considering what we're doing and what we've done with our world traveling and our high-powered cars, maybe like the Germans after the Holocaust, we'll prefer not to talk about our past.
That's right. We may live through a period of great dissociation and repress many things as we go into this future. I think that's one of the reasons why we are so good at living in denial even now. All of us, to some extent, live in denial. We may talk about these questions and then return to our everyday lives. So dissociation is a strategy that we rely on quite often, and we might find ourselves relying on it more and more as the years go by and the realities we face get more and more difficult. The problem with that strategy, however, is that certain emotions that we still will feel will surface in other ways, with more anger or more intense political beliefs, etc. I think we're already seeing signs of this shift taking place.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think some people have cracked under the strain of the contradiction, and I look at the many privileged Westerners who are busy building the past, like the ISIS caliphate in the Middle East. I wonder if those, you know, young people who are raised in good families and they've got everything in front of them and they head off and sort of regress, in my point of view, to some very barbaric behavior, it could be partly the result of our future shattered by climate change.
I think that's right. I'm not sure. I don't know enough about what people living in the countries affected by ISIS know about climate change, if it's part of their discourse. But certainly we see more extreme and radical political beliefs arising around us in the parts of the world familiar to us where, indeed, climate change is a central concern. So we have a kind of shift in, going back to your point earlier about enlightenment and hope and progress, our political shift may already be taking place towards fiercer and more violent kinds of rhetoric or action.
And you ask in your book, can we be traumatized by events that have not yet taken place? And on radio, I've talked about that, and I've called this the new PTSD, pre-traumatic stress disorder. We're damaged by knowing about climate change.
We are. Trauma normally happens to people when they haven't been able to prepare themselves for an event. It takes place and shatters parts of their psyche, and they're haunted by it because they can't quite live the event thoroughly. And I agree with you, there is a kind of pre-traumatic stress disorder because we're living through events in ways we can't anticipate and that we're not ready for, even if they're coming down the pike. So it's a rather different version of trauma, but it still is real. One of the reasons this is of concern is that we still are talking about very large crises and difficulties. We're talking about genocide. Some commentators have pointed out that in Darfur, people were displaced by changing ecosystems and ended up living next to people who lived differently, and thus violence took place. We are going to see many more examples of that in the future. One of our models of trauma has been genocide that people have endured in the last 4 or 5 decades. Now we're looking ahead to possible genocide, and it will be difficult to prevent them. So we definitely have a kind of pre-traumatic scenario unfolding around us.
Yes, and as cities get buried too and people have to leave, there's going to be a lot of interesting things happen. There's one place where I completely disagree with your book, just one chapter. The rest of it I was sort of nodding and going, yes, this is good stuff. I've looked into carbon offsets and I've found fraud after fraud, and even the well-intentioned ones like protecting a forest, they can disenfranchise Aboriginal people or the forest can be lost to a wildfire overnight. I wonder, David, aren't we just kidding ourselves with these carbon offsets?
I think we often are. I think we have to be extraordinarily careful what carbon offsets we buy. The difficulty is when people, friends of mine here in Maine with whom I speak about these questions, say that they don't like offsets, but they do continue to fly. They do continue to use energy on a significant level. And often people are very careful in their home and in their car and in their food, but they will still get on the airplane and fly somewhere. And I think the difficulty for me is if a person dislikes offsets but still uses energy in that form, there's a kind of hypocrisy there. So if people don't like offsets and have researched them and find that they're fraudulent, then the consequence, it seems to me, would be that they would simply not use energy on that level. And that might well be the very best approach. And what I suggest in my chapter on offsets is that we use offsets strategically but temporarily, only in the next few years as we learn how to live locally and to give up that kind of travel. So I see it as a bridge, as a way of remaining ethical rather than hypocritical as we shift to a different way of life.
Now, another place I have a small objection for the book, you say that we should take responsibility not just for present violence and wars, but all that was in the past and all that will come in the future. The book, it seems to me, seems to presume that this rationalized voice that we hear talking in our heads is really a powerful agent, and I'm not sure about that. Our fragile self is not really able to change much about biology, and we certainly can't force evolution. Do you see what I'm getting at?
I do indeed, and that's another part of that very same chapter. I talk about how if we do what we need to do now, we will end up having taken responsibility for the ecological damage that our species has done in the past because of its analogy with the present. We will also have taken responsibility for what is to come. But the chapter also emphasizes we probably will not take that action. So how will we live? How can we be ethical agents in the midst of a scenario in which we refuse to act? So that's another part of the question. And what I propose in that chapter is that we take responsibility for that disaster itself, that we put it to our own account, that we, in effect, accept our own participation in a species that has done what it will be doing here in a minute to the whole planet. So that's another level of responsibility. It's being responsible for the absence of effectiveness, of rationality, as you were just describing it. That's a terrible kind of responsibility to take on ourselves. But if we do that, we will retain some level of ethical self-respect in the face of what we've done. At least we can say, yep, we did that. That's due to us. And if we can't do anything more than that, at least we can do that.
So once climate change is truly irreversible, and that point may have already been crossed, then scientists say the melting of glaciers cannot be stopped, changes in the oceans will proceed. Won't we feel a sense of relief then when climate change is finally out of our hands?
I've never thought of that. What kind of relief would that be if we're faced with pretty strange and devastating weather effects and climate patterns, droughts, food shortages, and so on? Would it be relief that we will simply have to submit to what's coming?
I'm afraid it is. But we'll see. You ask really in a sense in the book whether we've already chosen calamity, and I don't have a good answer for that. It appears right now that we have. I'm still hopeful that we might choose something different in the few short years to come.
It's worth a massive effort from all of us who care to see if we can turn the corner and with the changes that we could make, salvage something like a viable biosphere. It really does seem like we're on the very verge of it all being too late, but you never know. There are so many imponderables in the science and so many tricky parts of it that we should still proceed as if we can make some real difference.
Yeah, we can't be absolutely 100% sure that it's too late or that the future may not be kind to many people, but we'll see. Stolen Future, Broken Present, The Human Significance of Climate Change, that's the new book by our guest David A. Collings. He's a professor of English at Maine's Bowdoin College. You can buy the book, and I hope you will, or read it online as an open publication, and find those links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. David, thanks for this conversation and for the bravery in your book about the meaning of climate change. It's been long overdue.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to further conversations like this with you and your listeners.
All right. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Next up, Martin Persson from Sweden and Olli Tammiletto from Finland as Radio EcoShock covers the world. We know cutting down the tropical forests drives extinction of plants and animals. It also destabilizes the climate around the world. But that's either getting better or it's the fault of poor farmers who need a place to live after all. Wrong on both counts. Tropical deforestation is still going on, and these forests are being cut down or burned for products you and I consume. That's the news in a report commissioned for the Center for Global Development. We've reached the lead author, Martin Persson, an assistant professor at Chalmers University of Technology in Gothenburg, Sweden. Martin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Before we get to those villains possibly behind tropical deforestation, you were just at a major international forest conference in London. Please tell us about that.
So the title of the workshop was How Business Can Tackle Deforestation. Mainly, I was one of the few researchers there. It was mainly people from environmental NGOs and a lot of representatives from big corporations like Unilever and Nestle and McDonald's and Mars discussing how corporations can help stopping deforestation.
Well, I'm interested in that, and we will get to it. One other question first, though. Saving the rainforest has been a campaign since at least 1990. Is the movement getting stronger, and will we still have any tropical forests left to save?
Yes, on both accounts, I would say. So first of all, as you said in the introduction, tropical deforestation is still rampant. We're losing about 10 million hectares of tropical forest every year. But there are also positive signs. Brazil, which has had the highest deforestation rate in the tropics, has reduced their deforestation rate in the Amazon by 70-80% in the last years. So there are positive signs, but there are also negative signs. But I think what has happened in the last few years is that, I mean, in as you say, in the 80s especially, tropical deforestation was really high on the agenda, but it has come back to the agenda again in the last few years, especially in relation to international climate negotiation and something called RED, reduced emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, which is an idea that rich countries, developed countries, is going to compensate tropical developing countries for reducing their deforestation rate and thereby reducing emissions of carbon dioxide. So I think this has helped lift again tropical deforestation on the international agenda. And I think we see a lot of things happening now, which is positive.
Well, let's get to your new report. The title is Trading Forests, Quantifying the Contribution of Global Commodity Markets to Emissions from Tropical Deforestation. What period of time are we talking about in this report?
So we're looking at especially the period 2000 to 2009. So we couldn't go beyond 2009 to the last few years because we didn't have good enough trade data. So what we do is we try to link deforestation to production of agricultural commodities like soy, beef, palm oil, and then we trace that production through international trade to where it's finally consumed. So to try to quantify to which extent tropical deforestation is driven by this international demand, but also domestic demand of these commodities.
Can you give us one or two examples of products that we may be buying that come from former tropical forests?
So, I mean, one thing, if you take soy is a major feed ingredient to produce chicken, pig meat, and beef in developed countries. So we import a lot of soy, feed that to our animals, and then we eat the animals. So that's one thing. Palm oil is a vegetable oil that you can find in a lot of products in your grocery store. Cookies and things like that. Chocolate bars, maybe, and lots of things.
So we're buying a chunk of the rainforest when we buy some of those
yeah,
things.
In essence, yeah.
From Sweden, we're talking with Martin Persson. Beyond Brazil, where are the deforestation hotspots that you studied?
So we looked at mainly Latin America, so four countries in Latin America, Brazil, which is the major deforester, but also Bolivia, Paraguay, and Argentina. And then we looked at Southeast Asia, where we looked at Indonesia, which is the big country in terms of deforestation, but second comes Malaysia, and then also Papua New Guinea. And in Latin America, the main drivers of deforestation is beef production, so you're cutting down the forest to make way for pastures. But in the last decade or so, soy has become an increasingly important driver of deforestation, so expansion of soy production. And in Southeast Asia, it's mainly timber, paper and pulp production, so short rotation forests replacing natural forest, and then, of course, palm oil production, so oil palm plantations.
I don't see the Congo in your study list. Should we be concerned about Africa's tropical forests as well?
So we did also look at Congo, but mainly more qualitatively. And the main reason for that is, although there is deforestation there, it's mainly driven by smallholders or people cutting down forests for local markets rather than this international demand. So there's quite a little commercial-driven deforestation there. So there it's more still the sort of the old picture of smallholders practicing slash and burn for subsistence needs.
And you're in Sweden. What is IKEA's policy on this?
So IKEA was actually in this workshop as well. And of course, they are aware of this problem and working with it and sort of have a policy not to source wood from deforested land.
Now, we know the international climate negotiations are based on the amount of greenhouse gases each country produces. And we also know rich countries exported a lot of their manufacturing emissions to places like China. Are we also, in a sense, exporting our agricultural emissions when we buy soy or palm oil from former tropical forest lands?
Yes, you can say so. And that's one of the reasons we did this analysis that we presented in the report, to actually try to quantify it, to see how much, for example, Europe is importing embodied emissions from land use change, from tropical deforestation.
So how much of the world's greenhouse gases are found in these trade flows from tropical deforestation?
So tropical deforestation, as I said, roughly 10 million hectares of forest are lost every year, and that gives rise to carbon emissions in the order of around 4.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide. What we find is when we look at our seven case countries and our four commodities, just those seven countries, four commodities, are responsible for one-third of total deforestation and roughly also one-third of the associated carbon emissions. So 1.7 billion tons of carbon dioxide that is linked to production of these commodities. Soy, beef in Latin America, palm oil, timber in Southeast Asia. And one-third of that then is exported, driven by export demand on average.
I sometimes have trouble picturing what that really means. Do you know what that is, say, as a percentage of the total carbon emissions that humans are creating?
So again, if you look at the total emissions from tropical deforestation, it's roughly 10% of total human emissions of greenhouse gases. So again, what we find is one-third of that 10%, so like 3%, is linked to deforestation in these seven countries for these four commodities.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Martin Persson. Scientists tell me it's not just the amount of carbon lost from the trees or burned. The tropical soils hold immense amounts of carbon that also gets released. I'm thinking of peat in Indonesia, for example. Did you study that as well?
Yeah, so our numbers includes the emissions from peat drainage. So when you drain the peat lands in Southeast Asia to cultivate palm oil or oil palms, or also for short rotation forest for pulp and paper, you get huge emissions of carbon dioxide, and that's included in our numbers.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I just talked with a group that are working on the fact that many of these rainforests are being turned into pulp, but that is then dissolved and turned into clothing. So people are actually wearing tropical rainforests with their latest fashions.
Yeah. And then, so what has happened in the last year is that a lot of companies have come forward and taken what you can call zero deforestation pledges. So committing to not five primary commodities from land that has been deforested. And one of those companies is H&M, another Swedish company. So cotton, for example, can also be linked to produced on deforested land and so on. So, yes, it's not only restricted to food commodities.
Well, where does one of the world's largest beef sellers, McDonald's, stand on this issue?
So they are also one of the companies that have taken these zero deforestation pledges. And then they were also present in the London workshop and discussing these questions openly. So they are aware of these problems and taking steps to solve it. One of the things that was clear at the London conference was the recognition that we've really come a long way in the last few years, especially in the last year. A lot of companies have gone out and taken these zero deforestation pledges. So they've gone from sort of denial and denying that this is a problem to actually accept it and starting to take action. And this is, of course, has been driven by environmental NGOs that has really put the light on this and pushed them into action. But I think one of the main things that came out of this conference that I took with me is this. It started a discussion of how these corporations can not only stop contributing to forest loss, but also actively work for forest conservation. And that means engaging with policymakers and try to get tougher regulations, better enforcement of forest regulation in tropical countries in place. And I think that's where they can really make a difference. Because just the saying that we're not going to buy any soy or beef or palm oil from land that has been deforested in maybe the last 5 years or so won't solve the problem. Because deforestation is really driven by sort of the marginal demand. The extra demand is coming. So we can buy up if a subset of the total consumer or global consumption is consumers say that, yeah, we don't want any deforestation from our palm oil or from our soy. We can still buy up all this soy and palm oil that's being produced today. And then people that don't care, well, they will buy the share that comes from new conversion of forests. So I think, for me, I don't see that this certification and these deforestation, zero deforestation pledges alone will solve the problem. Where it can really make a difference if it's starting to change the sort of political economy around forest conservation policy in tropical countries. So if you can get these companies from opposing forest conservation policy to actually start working actively for it, then you can really start to make things happening.
Are there particular organizations or campaigns you think are doing good work trying to save tropical forests?
I think one of the organizations that has worked really actively on this is Greenpeace, and they have really pushed companies to take an action and getting an awareness around these issues. So I think they have been really important in this. You have other NGOs, one of them, the Forest Trust, that is working with these companies to try to make sure that, verify that the zero deforestation pledges are actually honored and that they don't have any deforestation in their supply chains and so on. So different NGOs work in different ways and sort of complement each other here, I think.
I'd like to put a plug in for RAN, the Rainforest Action Network, as well, and for Canopy, which a lot of people haven't heard about, but it's a group based in Canada that's doing good work in this field. As we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
The changes that we've seen in the last few years with increasing corporations' awareness around these issues, I think it's really something that also they are much more sensitive to these issues today than they were 5 or 10 years ago. And I think that means that as a consumer, you have a bigger chance today of actually making a positive change by pushing companies to take action here. So you can do it either by directly contacting companies, of course, or going through environmental NGOs in different ways, supporting them and so on.
Right. Look it up and find out where the things that you're buying are coming from, and so that we can maybe save some of the rich tropical forestation that belongs on this earth. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, Martin Persson. We've been looking at what is driving tropical deforestation. You can find links to the study from the Center for Global Development in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Martin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Why are the rich so amazingly blind to the extreme damage caused by private planes, multiple mansions, and endless shopping. And why do so many of us want to be just like them? Because, my friend, ecocide pays. That's the system we have. The more you pollute, the more you threaten the future, the better our society rewards you. We're going all the way to Finland today to find author and independent researcher Olli Tammiletto. He's published lots of books. I'm calling Olli about his new paper, Rewarding with a License to Commit Ecocide. That was presented at the 4th International Conference on Degrowth for Ecological Sustainability and Social Equity. That was held in Leipzig, Germany, at the beginning of September 2014. Olli, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's good to be here.
How was the Degrowth Conference in Leipzig this fall?
It was a great experience. There were over 3,000 participants and a lot of interesting discussion, and really it was like a growing movement.
3,000 people, that's pretty big. Is the idea of degrowth gaining traction as Europe's economies struggle for growth?
Yes, I think at least in Germany and in some countries, but not in our country. It's not so popular in Finland, for example.
When it comes to climate, I always ask myself, why do we do it? We know the weather's strange, animals are going extinct, the oceans are damaged, and still we think about flying to the tropics for a nice winter holiday. It's as though there were two worlds, one for rational thought and then the other for our personal rewards. Have you noticed this?
Yes, certainly. It's almost like people were a little bit schizophrenic, that they really, on the other hand, they know all these things, but then they think that their private life and what they are doing in their job is somehow apart from these problems.
And I think your paper has a fundamental answer. People do it because our economy rewards pollution. What brought you to that conclusion?
I have had that kind of ideas earlier, but then some people encouraged me to make a research paper about this, and then really I went deeper to this problem, and the whole reward system now is in a way connected to climate change, that really people are rewarded by a license to do something very harmful. That idea is in a way obvious, but because of this schizophrenic frame of mind, people don't usually connect it.
So what can you suggest as an alternative?
Okay, I was also in my paper dealing with the alternative reward systems, and this kind of reward system, what we now have, it's based on high salaries. It hasn't been here always, that there have been other reward systems, and really respect and social status have been more important earlier. And now we have also, at the moment, alternative reward systems. For example, in most branches of sport, that you are only few sportsmen or women are professional. They are rewarded by medals, which are not so expensive, and they're not rewarded by giving them a lot of money. And this honor and respect is enough. And also in science and in many other fields of life, you are giving people respect mostly and not rewarding them with a lot of money. And so we could think that generally this alternative reward systems would be used instead of high salaries, and therefore there wouldn't be so much consumption because this high salaries and whole system connected to that, it's one of the reasons why this whole consumption society is running.
That's going to take quite a change in people's attitude, but I could see how it would work. As you say, it has worked in the past. You know, while I have you, I'm wondering, does Finland have doomers who expect a breakdown of the economy or even society itself?
Yes, certainly we have, but probably not so many as in USA or in other countries, because our economic development has been much more smoother than in many other parts of the world, so that people expect that everything is continuing as always.
And I know you have one well-known writer with an unpleasant solution. You've written about Pentti Linkola, and he says the only way to prevent the extinction of humans is fascism. What is his argument? Do we need a green Hitler?
Yeah, his idea is that there should be such an elite group of people who would command other people to consume less. And because he is quite a good writer and also such a living in a different way, he has quite many followers in Finland, yes, and even in other countries. But really, why he is so fascinating about fascism is that his family was very much right-wing orientated during the Second World War, so that how to say he has family ties to Nazism, and therefore he can write like that Nazism wasn't so bad thing after all.
So he grew up with a Nazi family.
Yes, you can say so. Yeah, because we had Nazis also, and but of course after a war they couldn't write and speak about those things openly anymore. So during the war we had such right wing people, and Pentti Linkola's family belonged to those.
Yes, in many countries, people were split, even in the Ukraine, for example. Some supported Hitler and others did not. It was not as clear-cut. Now, what was the position of the government of Finland? What is the position of the government of Finland on climate change? What, if anything, is Finland doing about it?
Yes, obviously it's doing many things, but you see that it's very bureaucratic, that it's doing what has been agreed in these climate negotiations, but all the time least possible, so that this whole European emission trading system is very vague. What's really happening is our emissions decreasing or increasing. It's the whole climate thing is very part of state bureaucracy, and formally Finland is doing something. And in my opinion, it's almost nothing.
I understand completely. I've just done a comprehensive radio program on dangerous nuclear reactors in Japan and the United States, but Finland has 4 reactors right on the Baltic Sea, with many more under construction or planned. Are there concerns about their safety?
Yes, certainly. There are a lot of people, probably most majority of people of Finland are very concerned about the safety of these reactors and future reactors, but unfortunately we have such a strong industrial lobby which can influence government, and therefore we haven't been able to stop those reactors. But of course, because of this opposition, we have much less reactors than was planned many years ago, all these activities of anti-nuclear movement, they haven't been in vain, but unfortunately the situation is bad.
Yes, they always cost more and take longer than is told to the people. And we know that nuclear power presumes authority. It forces the existence of a centralized distribution system and centralized power strong enough to protect those reactors for at least 100 years, if not more. Would you agree, Ollie, that accepting nuclear power can determine the shape of a society?
Yes, it really demands that permanent structures just to keep those reactors and their nuclear waste safe. And in a way, it has an influence on social structures, and that has been one of the reasons to oppose nuclear power in Finland and in other countries. But on the other hand, many people who are near this industrial circles, they have such an hierarchical and authoritarian value system, and for them, to this value system, nuclear power fits, so that for them, in a way, they love those hierarchical systems which are needed for nuclear power.
You've been a public intellectual for a long time, Ollie. Back in the early 1980s, you were publishing on the environment, war, and the nuclear threat. Have the issues really changed?
They have, and not because all the issues have existed all these years, but on the other hand, the emphasis of what is regarded to be most important, that's changed quite a lot, so that we spoke about climate change already in 1970s, but it was not such a big issue. But now it's most important issue, and on the other hand, nuclear power is not regarded to be so important as it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Yes, you were living right on the border of the Soviet Union. Did you fear that there would, well, at one point there was a war with the Soviet Union, but with Finland. Did you fear that there would be more hostilities or even a nuclear war as you were growing up and getting older?
Yes, really, that was quite a lot of discussion about that, and that's the reason why most people don't want to join this NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because most people in Finland think that the only way to prevent war is to disarm and to negotiate and not to build military alliances. And really, this peace thinking or peace movements have been strong all the time in Finland. But what the government thinks, that's a different thing altogether.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us or talk about, Ollie?
I think that what I was writing in that paper, is one important thing is that this present climate policies, they affect poor people more than rich, so that this is a basic injustice, that really those who are causing climate change, they are suffering least, and those who are not causing it, those poor people, they are suffering most. But in addition, that is in a way a third injustice, that most of these policies which are now practiced in many countries, they have a negative effect on poor people, because poor people cannot, very often they cannot decrease their energy consumption so easily than rich people, because their energy is like for basic needs like farming and.
I can see how that works, you know. I mean, if the crops fail here, I'll buy my food from somewhere else, or maybe I'll build a greenhouse to protect myself from climate change. But if you are making a dollar a day in India or Indonesia and the crops fail, you and your family will starve.
Yeah, that's right. And also the same applies even inside rich countries, that taxation, if your country is taxing carbon pollution, the rich people can invest to their houses so that their energy consumption gets small. But for poor people, those kind of investments are impossible. And in a way, the poor people's consumption is locked in. They can't change their energy and consumption, and the emissions are dependent on social structures much more than for rich people, because rich people, they can always consume less, because most of their emissions are caused by what they are buying, and most of what they are buying is not necessary.
You can find Ollie Tammalito's work in Finnish and English at his website at tammalito.info. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it close to correctly, maybe not, but the last name is spelled T-A-M-M-I-L-E-H-T-O. And I will put a link to Ollie's work, including the paper we've discussed, in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday. It has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
We are totally out of time. Check out the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page, or get all our past programs as free MP3 files at ecoshock.org. Don't forget the links for this week's program in the show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening again this week. I'm Alex Smith.